Welcome to Earth 2, a world amazingly like the Earth we're all familiar with, yet with surprising differences.
Clark Kent is editor of the Daily Star and married to its top reporter, Lois Lane.
This story takes place years ago, early in the wedded life of
Mr. and Mrs. Superman.
When a couple decide to take that big leap and get wed, they still might have some doubt about what they might have done instead. To leap into the future together and wonder what it all will bring, it might be a whole lot easier to leap a tall building. But if anyone can achieve that feat, we bet these two sure can. Now, we'd like you to meet Mr. and Mrs. Superman.
Hello and welcome to Justice Society Presents, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and the second installment of a series covering the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature. I'm Cindy Franklin.
And I'm Chris Franklin, and after a very long hiatus, we're back. This is the occasional series within a series you've heard Chag mention on JSA in the 90s and wondered if he'd bumped his head on something.
Again.
Yes. Yes, it's time to cover another tale from the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature in the Superman Family comic series from 40 years ago.
If you haven't heard our first episode released during JS April podcasting event last year, we recommend you do so for the full history of the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature. But if you just want a quick rundown, this was one of several features that ran in Superman Family during its dollar comic phase of the late 70s, early 80s.
It was set during the 1950s and focused on the early wedded days of Clark Kent and Lois Lane of Earth 2, the original Golden Age versions of comics' first couple as newlyweds.
Since this is Justice Society Presents, our primary focus here is to cover stories that feature guest appearances by and tie-ins to other JSA members.
Which is just what this story does from Superman Family number 204, December 1980.
Just like our previous issue, the cover by Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano features Supergirl in the center, with figures of her and the Earth One versions of Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane on the left. Lois, Jimmy, and Clark Kent also receive vignettes from their stories inside, but we're interested in the vignette in the bottom left of the cover, which asks, who is Mr. and Mrs. Superman? Surprise caller. JSA fans know that that's Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt leaping out of the telephone receiver Clark Kent is holding.
So what do you think of this cover?
It's got a lot of things in there, but, I mean, it makes me want to pick it up.
Yeah, that's what we said last time. I mean, they're busy, but they definitely give you your bang for your buck.
They're busy but contained.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it looks like a comic book page.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, the Supergirl and the Enchantress is the villain. This is when she went bad. She was an old, you know, very obscure DC hero from the 60s. But yeah, so it's a cool cover. And I like the little Mr. and Mrs. Superman with the Thunderbolt. He's got his nose is very dark pink, which is his top lightning bolts are, and it looks like he's been drinking too much. But yeah, it's Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano, so it looks great. The Rescue of His Majesty, Johnny Thunder. Writer E. Nelson Bridwell, penciler Kurt Schaffenberger, inker Frank Chiaramonte, letterer Milt Snappin, colorist Adrian Roy, editor Julius Schwartz.
In his Daily Star office, editor Clark Kent answers the phone, and both he and his wife Lois Lane are shocked when a living pink lightning bolt emerges from the receiver. Clark recognizes Johnny Thunder's magical thunderbolt, and the T-Bolt recognizes him as Superman. He magically changes Clark into his Superman duds and tells him Johnny has sent his servant to the Man of Steel for help.
Thunderbolt explains that Johnny's recent disappearance is tied to his origins in the country of Badnesia. Superman and Lois had heard rumors that the land had a new king and a weapon more powerful than the atomic bomb. Thunderbolt reveals Johnny is that king and he is that weapon. Born on the seventh hour of the seventh day of the seventh month in a year ending in seven, Johnny was deemed magical and kidnapped as an infant by a Badnesian shaman who gave him a mystical belt before returning him home. He eventually learned his magical heritage, and the belt gave him control over the genie-like thunderbolt via the magic word Cei-U, C-E-I dash letter U, or as it sounds in English, just Cei-U. Johnny and the thunderbolt foiled the Badnesian's plan to kidnap him as an adult, but recently the shaman learned that Johnny was no longer wearing his belt, which gave the wizard the ability to interfere with Johnny's control over the thunderbolt. When all his control was gone, the shaman kidnapped Johnny once more, gave him his powers back, and installed him on the throne as his puppet, forbidding him from using the Thunderbolt against him with a powerful hex. But Johnny could send the T-Bolt out for help, and who better to help than Superman?
Superman plans to pose as a powerful wizard to challenge the shaman, but Lois suggests she would be a better fit than the world-famous Superman. Thunderbolt whips her up a costume and magic wand, and Superman engraves something on it before they head to Badnesia. Lois interrupts the shaman's attempt to stir his people into world conquest and appears to lift the corrupt sorcerer off the ground. But it's actually Superman doing it at super speed, which makes it invisible to the eye. The shaman commands Johnny to order the Thunderbolt to remove her powers, but since she has none, he can't comply. Lois gloats that none can overpower her unless they say aloud the secret name on her wand. The shaman orders T-Bolt to make an exact duplicate of the wand, reads the name, and commands, "Tell your servant to make the evil one helpless." Johnny hears this as "make the evil one helpless," and the Thunderbolt does so, taking away the shaman's hex powers and wrapping him in a straitjacket.
Johnny tells Superman and Lois he's going to remain king long enough to teach the Badnesians about democracy and how to elect their leaders. When Superman brings up Johnny's mother and his adopted daughter, Peachy Pet, Johnny answers, "Just say you saw me, I'm okay, but I want to hang around and pitch a little liberty to these folks." The very literal Thunderbolt responds by hanging Johnny from a flagpole and making him throw a tiny Statue of Liberty, much to his anger. So what did you think of this one?
It was cute. I mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun. Johnny often gets a bad rap among comic fans, and he has been roasted pretty hard on this network, including the episode of Ryan Daly's Secret Origins show that covered that title's retelling of his backstory and first appearances. We even joined in on that, with you being pretty brutal, as I recall, about it. You probably don't even remember that, do you?
Nah.
Okay. But that was, it was all a gag. Johnny is way better than Snapper Carr or Marvin from the Super Friends. At least he has powers or knows someone who does.
You really rag on Marvin so bad, man.
MeTV Toons plays the Super Friends, and they, of course, it doesn't take them long to cycle through because they play an episode. They play two episodes a day.
Right.
So they play it for an hour. Or those original series, first season episodes are an hour, and they feel like they're 5 hours. But when they get back to those, I'm just like, oh, my God, I can't. Well, I just can't. I usually don't watch them. I just can't. But let's talk about Johnny Thunder.
Okay.
Johnny Thunder was created by writer John B. Wentworth and artist Stan Asher and debuted in Flash Comics number 1, January 1940, which actually means it came out in late 1939, alongside Jay Garrick, The Flash, and Carter Hall, Hawkman, so with great company. And
there you go.
The Whip. So, I'll just put that in for Ryan. At first, Johnny was unaware that he had a magic Thunderbolt and inadvertently called him when he said, "Say you," which he did a lot. Eventually, he figured it out.
Yeah, it took him a bit, though.
Yeah, it took him a bit. Johnny was, no fooling. Johnny was a little dense. In addition to his regular feature in Flash Comics, Johnny also appeared in World's Best Comics number 1, World's Finest 2-3, New York World's Fair Comics number 2, and All-Star Comics number 2, which led to him appearing in All-Star Comics number 3, winter 1940, attending the first meeting of the Justice Society of America as a non-member. Johnny became a mascot in the JSA until The Flash received his own title in All-Flash and was bumped to honorary member, giving his spot to Johnny in All-Star number 6. The thing back then was, if you had your own solo title, you became an honorary member, which is why Superman and Batman were honorary to begin with.
Gotcha.
Because back then, DC / All-American didn't want to oversaturate the market with their main characters, which is like hard to imagine now.
Oh, yeah, that's Anthem.
Yeah, exactly. In Flash Comics number 21, Johnny met young girl Peachy Pet and adopted her as his daughter in the following issue. And, of course, Peachy Pet comes up in this story. In Flash Comics number 86, August 1947, Johnny met the Black Canary, who became a co-star in his strip and then took it over wholesale. The Thunderbolt also began to appear less frequently, retconned by the interference of the Shaman in this issue. There wasn't really any explanation, but now, you know, there is in this one. Johnny's last solo strip appearance was in Flash Comics number 91, January 1948, and his last appearance with the JSA in the Golden Age was in All-Star Comics number 39, February, March 1948. Black Canary took over his spot on the team there, too.
Good for her! Go, girl!
Which means the JSA had two women on the team, Wonder Woman and Black Canary. So, Johnny resurfaced in the revived Flash number 137, June 1963, along with several other JSAers, appearing in the flesh for the first time since the Golden Age cancellation of All-Star with issue number 57, February-March 1951. He appeared occasionally in the annual JLA-JSA team-ups, including JLA number 37 through 38, August-September 1965, where the evil Earth-1 version of Johnny first appeared, controlling the Thunderbolt and attacking the other heroes. This is really interesting. This led to toy maker Ideal thinking the Thunderbolt was a regular foe of the JLA, and he was the first JSA-related hero other than Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, which were really the Earth-1 versions anyway, to receive a toy figure in their Batman Justice League of America series.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
The villains are all one color like the Joker. I've got the Joker. That's the only villain figure I've got. But there's a Thunderbolt figure.
Oh, okay.
And it's Johnny's Thunderbolt. Before there was ever a figure of Alan Scott or Jay Garrick or Dr. Fate or the Spectre, there was a figure of Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt. Johnny is Earth-1 doppelganger in the Thunderbolt, also featured prominently in the JLA-JSA crossover in 1983 in JLA number 219 through 220. The events of this issue are referenced as part of Johnny and the T-Bolt's history, while the batshit crazy true origin of Black Canary is revealed.
Whoa. That which, still makes my head
which
hurt.
Thankfully was one of the, I will never argue that Crisis helped that out. That definitely needed to be fixed. Because, wow, okay. Getting into this story, I really like Kurt Schaffenberger's take on the Thunderbolt. He's got a great expressive face. I love Schaffenberger's art in general. What did you think of it?
Oh, it was good and clean. I mean, there was no mistakes about who everybody was, and, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think Frank Chiaramonte is his best inker, though. I missed Dan Atkins from the previous issue, but it's fine. It still looks good. Kurt Schaffenberger is such a, like you said, he's such a clean, you know, everything is very just visually clear that it's hard for an inker to mess him up, you know, I think. It's a good thing that Lois knew Clark was Superman.
I know, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, girl.
If this had been a few years earlier and the Thunderbolt had come out of the phone, then the cat would be out of the bag. Because T-Bolt just blew the secret by changing Clark into Superman right in front of her. So, and then we get Johnny Thunder 101 for those who don't know his origin. And why would you?
Right. I mean, we needed a little bit of...
Yeah. What did you think of his origin?
I was like, they kidnapped him, they put him back, and oh, let's just wear this belt you got from whoever, you know, we don't, you know, go ahead, just wear it, honey.
Yeah, they kidnap him, darken his hair and skin, which is like, you know. They leave out the part that a rival country tried to capture him, so the Badnesians hid him away, and he got in a boat, and he was eventually found by a ship that took him to the U.S., and his parents identified him by a strawberry birthmark on his left shoulder. But this is an 8-page story, so.
Jiminy crickets.
According to Who's Who, and you, yeah, I know you asked me about this, they come out and say Johnny was born in 1917. But EMB is being a little cagey here for some reason, even though the JSA is tied to World War II and Johnny was clearly in his early 20s.
Yeah.
So 1917 makes perfect sense that he was like 22 years old when he joined the JSA, or met the JSA.
Right, early 20s,
and first appeared, yeah. Much like Roy Thomas, EMB has to explain away story inconsistencies. Thunderbolt's absence from several of the Johnny Black Canary stories is explained by the shaman interfering with his powers because Johnny stopped wearing his magic belt. And that's why he quit the JSA as well. Not because everyone liked Black Canary way better than him.
No, that wasn't why. No.
And in the Justice League, the bat crap crazy Justice League story we talked about, they get more into that Johnny was like actually jealous and upset that, you know, she took over, you know, everybody liked her. And then he found out she was dating Larry Lance and he never had a chance with her. So it was just, he was kind of bitter about all that. So interesting that Johnny didn't ask Thunderbolt to seek out Flash or Green Lantern since he had an actual connection with them.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have an ongoing feature in a comic at the time either. So,
yeah, so I mean, there you go.
If I was Johnny, I'd be like, I'd call Alan Scott. Yeah. That's who I would call. So what did you think of Lois's sorceress harem outfit?
Very I Dream of Jeannie.
Oh, good point. Yeah, but she's got, I think she may have pioneered the Madonna bra.
Oh,
Because she's got the cone, the cylindrical cone thing.
Oh, going. Yeah.
But yeah, it's very I Dream of Jeannie, yeah. The magic wand Schaffenberger draws looks like the Ibis stick used by the mystical hero Ibis, who first appeared in Wiz Comics number 1 with Captain Marvel and was drawn in several Golden Age adventures by...
Kurt Schaffenberger.
That's right. A mere woman, the shaman is a sexist tool.
Misogynistic butthole.
And we know the answer. Boxers are briefs thanks to Superman tossing him around with his robes flying up. Which I thought was funny. Like, yeah. This guy's got like on boxer shorts. At least he's not going commando.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I find it funny that he comments, "Ow, you didn't have to do it so hard," when Superman dumps him on the steps of the throne.
I know.
The device that EMB uses to resolve this is very much like a typical way to defeat Mr. Mitch's Pitlick.
I know. That's what I thought. I was like, wait a minute. Which story am I in here?
Well, I think, in later stories said that the Thunderbolt was from the fifth dimension or a similar dimension that Mitch's Pitlick Batmite are from. So It's kind of all, I guess, works. And it hinges on Johnny, either mispronouncing... He doesn't really mispronounce anything. It's just in the comics, it's spelled this way. When Say You is spelled CEI-U, like I said.
Yeah.
And of course, Say You is SAY, space YOU. But I guess they're supposed to sound the same thing. It wouldn't work.
Exactly.
So in the same way with the name of the evil one or whatever, which we were like, how do we say this, while we're doing this synopsis? Well, you can look at the pages in the gallery. I'll post them and you can see how they're written there. But I gotta say, good on Johnny for sticking around to ease the Badnesians into a democratic society.
However.
Okay.
How old was his adopted daughter, Peachy Pet?
Well, she was a little kid in the 40s, so she's probably like a teenager or something now. She might be an adult, but she's probably an adult by now, I would think. This is probably mid-50s.
So, if she's an adult, okay. If she's a kid... I'm sorry, but his first responsibility is to his child.
Well, I'm assuming she's living with his mother. That's why they bring
him. Don't care.
I know. Johnny's one of those guys that let the grandparents raise his kids. I'm sure that that Peachy Pet has resurfaced at some point, but I never remember seeing her during the Bronze Age at all, other than in the surprint of Johnny's Who's Who entry.
Yeah.
I mean, she wasn't in Infinity Incorporated that I know of. She was never in a JLA-JSA crossover that I can recall. She may have showed up in Young Justice or something, because I know they had the old Justice people that were like Dan the Dynamite that were still alive, and Mary Girl of a Thousand Gimmicks,
right.
that you guys need to quit, you're going to get hurt, blah, blah, blah. So Peachy Pet may have showed up there. I can't remember. Listeners, if you know of a Peachy Pet appearance, that's a weird thing to say together. Let us know, since the Golden Age. And it may have been in the Stargirl Lost Generation comics where the Flash and Joan have a daughter now and all that stuff.
Those
characters that appeared, some of them that they created for that, and others... that they kind of dug up out that DC never did anything with. So let us know. But of course, the story has to end with Johnny looking the fool. So what did you think of the gag at the end?
it could have been better, but at the same time, I know that was in the vein that they were after. So
yeah, it was.
We'll give it to them.
It was very much like a Golden Age story.
Yeah,
that was a very Golden Age story ending. Yeah. This is a fun, goofy one, but it works well within the lore of Johnny's strip.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked it.
Yeah.
I thought it was good, yeah. We're going to take a quick promo break, then we'll return with your listener feedback on our first installment.
Science fiction, romance, swashbuckling adventure, all that and more is coming to DC Special Cast in 2026. I'm your host, Paul Ken. DC Special Cast is a podcast where each month a guest and I explore DC's special comics of the 1970s, like DC Special Series, DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, and others. This year, we'll have plenty of superhero action, including a special movie tie-in. But we also plan to cover Sergio Aragonés, The Star Hunters, Three Musketeers, and Love 1971.
But wait, there's more! Extra! Extra. Read all about it. I'm Sean M. Myers, and because Paul will not let me do a podcast about Newsies, we're going to do a special segment we are calling The Monthly Planet. I will join my Bat Brother Paul as we cover the 50th anniversary of the greatest series of DC house ads ever, The Daily Planet. Get ready to hear us talk about Direct Currents, Fred Hembeck, The Answer Man, and so much more.
So join us each month on DC Special Cast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now that's special.
And we're back. Now to go through the Metropolis mailbag for the comments you left at firewaterpodcast.com about our first Mr. and Mrs. Superman installment way back in April of 2025.
And now it's April of 26 as we record this.
Yes.
So there you go.
Yes.
Ben Sherman writes in, "Hi, Chris and Cindy. Thanks for doing this. I've been slowly discovering the many, many podcasts you've been putting out over the years, especially enjoying your Starman Chronicles segment of Supermates. Also, Chris, I always look forward to listening whenever I find a podcast with you and Ryan Daly together. Always great analysis and a lot of fun. Thanks for your continued dedication."
Well, thank you, Ben. Whenever anybody brings up the Starman Chronicles, I feel guilty because we've just basically not done that forever.
I know. I love the series.
I do too. It's just it's so dense. It takes so much effort to stay on top of it. And if you really want to reference back, and you've really got to be deep into it,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to like immerse yourself in that world again to do it properly. Maybe one of these days we'll get back to it. We said we were going to do it here on Justice Society Presents. We did one episode here. We haven't done one since. So I do apologize for that. But thank you for listening and for listening to Batman Nightcast, which I suppose you listen to since you like me and Ryan together, which of course we do that once a month. So, you know, at least we're doing that. So our friend Keith G. Baker wrote in to say, "Great first ep, Franklin's. However, it seems to abruptly end at the 2050 mark. Is there a problem with the file?" Yes, there was. Thank you. Keith actually was the first one to point that out. I was at work and was scrambling, and I believe Siskoid jumped in and fixed it for us. It was just one of those weird things where it didn't upload properly.
A little snafu.
I had a problem with that for a while. I don't know what was going on. It was something really strange. Ito Bozno writes in, "Oh man, it's so great to hear you two talk about Bronze Age or thereabouts comics again. Otherwise, I have to wait a year for your comic section of the House of Frankenstein to get my fix." And then it took us a year to get back to this. "Love the idea of reviewing these Mr. and Mrs. Superman backups, even though I was never a regular reader of any Superman title back then, except for some extent DC Comics Presents. I did manage to read a few of them, and I always recall finding them lighthearted and enjoyable. And this one you covered is no exception. I like the use of Selina and Bruce's wedding as a plot device, and having Lois and Clark do a bit of Nick and Nora as they try to find out the culprit." Yeah, there was definitely some Thin Man elements in this story. So thank you again for listening, and sorry again it took us another year to get back to this.
Super Captain writes in, "Yay, the Franklin's return to the JSA Presents. This was a great addition to JSA April. I have a vague memory of this story related to the plot device of the two Kents. I bought plenty of Superman family issues as a kid, so I must have seen it there. My missus loves Lois and Clark, and especially the Bruce and Selina relationship, so I think I'll encourage her to give this one a go, too. Thanks."
Yeah, that's great. I hope she enjoyed it. Let us know. You'll have to let us know in the comments, or you don't have to, but we'd appreciate it if you did. My Nightcast partner, Ryan Daly, the aforementioned Ryan Daly, writes in, "Great first episode, Franklin's. Delightful story to introduce this series. We all know the real joy is hearing your open flirting on the podcast. Never change."
I don't flirt.
Whatever.
What? You ought to be glad.
I am. I didn't say I wasn't.
Gord Tolton writes in, "Earth 2. Sigh. I'm so much happier here. I'm betting that Dick Grayson would have got to be president."
Yeah, probably. Probably so. No comment after that. Hal writes in, "Those Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories were always a fun read back in the day. You made them as fun as I remember. Enjoyable show. Sounds like you love those stories as much as I did back then." Yeah, they are a lot of fun. That's why we're doing them. They're fun. They're little short stories that mm-hmm. we can enjoy and get in and out. It's you know, and we're having fun with it, even though it took us forever to get back to it.
Sean writes in, "This is such a fun show. Your love of the Mr. and Ms. Superman stories really shines through. I was smiling through the entire episode."
Well, thank you, Sean. And I think Sean there is, Sean from the Eastbound Down, our Wonder Woman podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I believe that's our Sean. So Paul Keehan writes in, who's also on our network and does DC Special Cast and did Batman Family Reunion and does other shows on the network, like the Sandman Slept Here segment he does with Ryan, who I should have mentioned. Ryan does that, and Max Romero, where they cover the Sandman Mystery Theater series here on Justice Society Presents. Paul writes, awesome episode, Chris and Cindy. My mom still addresses snail mail like Mr. and Mrs. Paul Keehan for a couple, but if writing only to the wife, she now has moved on to using her actual name. I think it was just etiquette to address things that way back in the day. Yeah, it was. It was.
I mean, it always blew my mind. Chris's mom always signed her name Mrs. Roy Franklin, and I'm like, if you had known Chris's mother, you would know that, trust me, subservience, she was not.
that's definitely true. Yeah.
It's just an etiquette thing. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. The story and conversation were great. I love this feature, and I'm so glad that you two are taking it on. It is amazing to me as well that there isn't a nice little Mr. and Mrs. Superman trade paperback. Yeah, I mean, come on, DC. One of your DC finest books would be great with this. I mean, and with all the, Superman and Lois, like everybody fully accepting now that Superman and Lois should be married, then you need to go with the original version and print that. Yes.
Nate the Great writes in, I remember this. Also, a Mr. and Mrs. Batman might have been fun too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of surprised they didn't do that at some point in some backup, especially after this one, I guess, proved successful enough to run for several years. But Rob Kelly of this very network writes in, Catwoman didn't appear for 12 years. I did not know that. Completely unthinkable today. Yes, it very much is. One of my favorite things about the Earth 2 heroes once I got into comics was that DC allowed them to age and grow, get married, have kids, show their age, even die, of course. I never read these strips, but they look great, and if you squint, you can sort of imagine them as a sitcom-esque follow-up to The Adventures of Superman. It's the early 60s, and Clark and Lois are now married and get into wacky I Love Lucy-style shenanigans.
That's a fair
assessment. Yeah, it that kind of works that way. But Clark, I want to go stop a supervillain! That type of thing, yeah. Go ahead.
Lucille Ball never sounded like that.
She did after she smoked all them years. Have you ever heard Billy West do his Lucy on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast?
No. Gothos Mansion writes in, since I've been a Batman fan since I was 5, I hate that the Batman Catwoman Bruce Selina wedding was given such little real estate in the story, when Superman and Lois's wedding on Earth 2 got an entire issue. On the other hand, if DC had given readers a more developed Bat-Cat wedding story, we might not have gotten the absolutely brilliant Brave and the Bold 197. Without hesitation, I crown Brave and the Bold 197 as my favorite issue of the entire series, and I love, love, love Brave and the Bold. By the way, I don't like how the wedding was buried at the bottom of the cover. It wouldn't have been very visible on the spinner rack. I didn't get the issue until eBay, and I certainly would have bought the Bat-Cat wedding issue. Really, it is just odd that the wedding was in a Superman comic and not a Batman one.
Well, I think the only reason was they just didn't have a strip. This was like one of the few Earth 2 strips that they had. I mean, they could have put it, I guess they could have flashed back. Well, she wasn't born, so how could they flash back to the wedding in the Huntress strip in Wonder Woman? Because really, at the time this comic was printed, there was All-Star Squadron set on Earth 2 in the past, and there was the Huntress strip and this strip, and the Huntress strip was in Wonder Woman. And I mean, of course, they mention her parents in that series, but they, she wasn't there at the wedding because she wasn't born yet, so, yeah. Martin Gray writes in, congrats and thanks for an excellent new sub show, from the opening quote to the happy ending via the great theme song from Terry. I love Mr. and Mrs. Superman. I've been nagging DC for a collection for years. DC Finest anyone? See, Martin's on board. This strip was the epitome of charm. I've worshipped Kurt Schaffenberger's smooth styling since I was a little boy a few years ago, and I don't recall him ever drawing the S symbol this wonky outside of this strip. It was classic throughout his Lois Lane run. Presumably he was trying for a Golden Age look, but the shield changed so often it's tough to get one we can all agree on. Yeah, he definitely was just trying to mimic what I think Murphy Anderson, I did an article on the Earth 2 Superman for Back Issue, and I think the first time anyone gave him a distinct S symbol that harkened back to, you know, one of the transitionary S symbols that Superman actually had in the Golden Age was Murphy Anderson in that one pinup where the JSA's all standing together from the late 60s. And I think that was based on Fred Ray, the cover artist Fred Ray's take on Superman. Like he did the famous one where the eagle's landing on his arm, you know, that cover. And I feel like Schaffenberger's trying to emulate that, but it's just he's got the S like super lopsided within the shield. It's really just, it looks just like abstract shapes on his chest, even more so than usual. So, but no, yeah, definitely Kurt Schaffenberger normally drew the S shield fine. He, you know, just like Kurt Swan, like everybody did. It was just for this series.
Gene Papa writes in, "This was terrific. Thank you. Mr. and Mrs. Superman was the main reason I picked up Superman Family back in the day. And for years now, I've been agitating DC to release a trade collection of all the stories. I was told by a DC staffer a few years back that a collection was actually scheduled, but then there was a management change, and as is often the case in such circumstances, the pet projects of the previous regime were put on the back burner. I thought for sure they'd finally get around to it to coincide with the CW TV series, but they missed a golden opportunity with that."
Oh, completely agree, and that's heartbreaking to hear that they were that close to putting one out. I'm really hoping, I mean, DC's really on fire with these collections they've been doing lately, and apparently they're selling well, so I really hope we, you know, that happens. But yeah, the Superman and Lois TV series, which was great, by the way, was the perfect time to release it, and they didn't. So, but yeah, it was the reason I picked up Superman Family, too. I mean, honestly, I don't even know how often I read the Jimmy Olsen strip and the Lois Lane strip. I usually read, if there was a Clark Kent strip, and I read the Supergirl story, but if it was just Jimmy and Lois, I don't know. There were a lot of times I probably didn't even read it if it didn't look super interesting to me, but. Robert McCarthy writes in, "Even as an anti-romance little kid, I thought Superman and Lois should be married. What the hell else are they going to do? We'll continue to just do the same shenanigans where Lois tries to, you know, reveal a secret and find a secret out and look like a total shrill, and that Clark looks like a jerk for not just telling her. So, mm-hmm. You know, that type of stuff that just needs to go away. So,
Shag writes in, "Chris and Cindy, this was absolutely delightful. I'm not familiar with these strips at all, so it was a joy discovering these adventures through your episode. And so excited to have even more excellent JSA-related content on the JSA Presents feed."
Well, you're welcome, Shag. And of course, Shag does most of the heavy lifting on the Justice Society Presents series with his JSA in the 90s and soon-to-come JSA in the 2000s. So that's praise from the keeper of the JSA flame here on the network. Doug Adamson writes in that this was fantastic fun. "I realize there is so much of those dollar comics and other anthology series in the 70s and 80s I had no idea about. So it was a delight to hear about this." Well, thank you, Doug. Nice to hear from you. And of course, Doug is one of the co-hosts on the Monitor Tapes that covers Crisis on Infinite Earths. Definitely check that out. Mm-hmm. Our pal and theme song writer Ward Hill Terry writes in, "Thank you for using my song. Your podcast inspired me. Regarding Lois asking Clark about spending, back then women were not allowed to own their own credit card. Lois may have had a charge account at some stores in Metropolis, but the money was very likely tied to Clark's bank account. And if they had a joint account, I bet the bank would have wanted the husband to be in control of the money. I believe there are some current elected office holders who would like this to return." Uh-huh. "Dick Grayson for president. Don't put the blame on Roy Thomas for shared surnames. It was E. Nelson Bridwell who pointed out the Dent kit switch in the introduction to Batman from the 30s to the 70s. He also connected Fawcett's Freddie Freeman, Captain Marvel Jr., with Quality's Kit Freeman, Kit Eternity, by establishing them as brothers once they were the property of DC. And Tom DeFalco connected Roy, Speedy Harper, to Jim Guardian Hopper in a Jimmy Olsen story. Both were before Roy came back to DC." Well, that's a good point. I think Roy just, he gets the brunt of it because he did so much of it in All-Star Squadron. He made Ted Knight from DC, Starman, and Sandra Knight from Quality, Phantom Lady, be cousins. He made Dick Grayson and I think it's Bob Grayson, Robot Man's friend, be cousins. So if you had the last name, you were cousins. Mm. So I had the same last name. So, but yes, E. Nelson Bridwell, Tom DeFalco, people like that. All comic writers are honestly, they try to shrink the world by making connections. And sometimes it gets a little overwrought, but you know.
Brett Young writes in, "Great show, Cindy and Chris. Love the idea of covering this series as you want. not beholden to the order. I always liked Mr. and Miss Superman as this Dick Van Dyke's show style look at the Golden Age. This story was pretty fun. Well, except for the poor bastard who got his fellas blasted with X-ray vision from point-blank range. Take it easy, Clark. Looking forward to new episodes.
Yeah, that poor guy's sterile. Yeah, that is, of course, for Brett Young, from also from the network and the Fantastic Four. So thank you, Brett. And then Captain Entropy rounds up the feedback in the Metropolis mailbag with, can't remember any of the comments I thought of when I listened, but I enjoyed it. Thank you for doing this, both of you. I enjoyed the Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories I caught growing up, but I especially appreciated the fact that DC would do them. Just the existence of the strip, you know. It runs counter to what any marketer might have expected to be commercial, I think. Yeah, I think Julius Schwartz, he might have been the only editor that would have ever greenlit this. So I do definitely appreciate that. But it also, you know, it filled out the book, and it also gave them a chance to have another Superman story in it. Which there weren't often Superman stories in Superman Family. There were Clark Kent stories, like Private Life of Clark Kent, but that allowed them to put Superman on the cover, too. I think that was part of it as well. That's all the feedback for this time, but please leave your comments on episode 2 that we're doing right now at fireandwaterpodcast.com, and we will get back to reading them eventually. We probably won't do it in episode 3 because we're planning on recording that pretty much right after this, but please, you know, send us your comments, and I usually respond to all of them in real time anyway. So that will wrap things up this time, but don't worry, we actually have another episode already in the works, so look for it sometime soon in amongst Shag's JSA in the 90s episode and Ryan, Paul, and Max's The Sandman Slept Here series.
A big thanks to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. Ward Hill Terry, for his wonderful Mr. and Mrs. Superman theme you heard at the beginning of this episode. Terry also provides our House of Frankenstein theme over on our Supermate show. Follow Terry's band, Stop Calling Me Frank, on their Facebook page. Check the show notes for more info.
This episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. A while back, we realized we needed some help with those expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you are enjoying the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you are there, please consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. At certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to
Alex Osias,
Bill Bear,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
Ducky,
Extremely Uncanny,
George Van Note,
Jason Keane,
Jeffrey Owens,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Wetter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Zimkowski,
Roger Preeb,
Russell Burbage. Oh, Russell.
Yeah, hey. Yeah. Symbol pending.
Ted Kilvington.
And Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast.
Thank you for listening.
Don't miss the next thrill-packed episode in the Amazing Adventures of Superman. Superman is based on the original character appearing in Superman magazine.